this area.
Most of the male jirgas in Swat are opposed to the female jirga. But one has not only accepted the woman's jirga, but has offered its support. Some locals say that's because it works on the humanitarian cases only and does not address religious issues. Nayaz Ahmad, a local journalist, says the woman's jirga is appropriate for some issues.
I have observed the work of the women's jirga in Saidu Sharif, and I believe it's a good thing that women have formulated a jirga to sort out their issues at a basic level. I have talked to their head, Tabassum Bashir, and she told me about the issues that women do not want to discuss with men, so it's a good thing that domestic issues and small disputes could be sorted out locally before going to the police or court.
But women's rights advocate Tabassum Bashir does not consider local and domestic disputes the prime responsibility of her jirga. She believes in across the board justice for women and girls being targeted in the society. Domestic violence is one of her priorities, but she wants the government to step in to end violence against women. The increasing number of female killings bothers her more than the domestic violence, and she wants the blood spree to end immediately.
I would like to discuss a very important issue here, that we talk about female education and women's rights everywhere. We talk a lot about them. First, the domestic violence bill implemented in this province has not been properly administered here. Second, our girls will only grow up, study, and become a mother or a sister if they stay alive. In other cases, they won't become anything at all.
Despite criticism and bashing by the traditional jirgas in the city, the 25 members of Pakistan's first women's jirga say that they will stay strong, fighting to empower local women and strengthen human rights in the tribal areas. Malik Ayub Sumbul, Free Speech Radio News, Saidu Sharif, Swat Valley.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening today. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
And as WBAI ends its broadcast day for September the 4th, this Wednesday, and enters our broadcast day for September 5th, I'd like you to join me in a small prayer. Lord, we beseech thee, no gremlins. May Jim Freund arrive promptly and safely. May the studio door stay open. May nothing go wrong. As we present next, Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM, it is midnight, and it is time for Earthwatch. Stay tuned. Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund coming up at 1:30 after this show.
Greetings. You're tuned to WBAI in New York, broadcasting at 99.5 megahertz FM. Or, if you're mobile, we invite you to join us streaming live worldwide at stream.wbai.org. This is Earthwatch, and I'm Robert Knight in New York. In today's program, we cover the latest legislative collaboration with an executive conspiracy by the Obama administration to expand its unconstitutional covert war against the nation of Syria. Also, a tutorial on the history and mechanics of illegal American warfare all across this earth. We'll also hear from our Prince of Peace, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and the Devil of War, presidential spokesmodel Barack Obama, your invader of Syria, emperor of Libya, killer of Gaddafi, enabler of Al-Qaeda, and serial violator of the United Nations Charter and the United States Constitution. I'm Robert Knight, and this is Earthwatch.
The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, a struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is a ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. They look like either hoping for some rain. And I see the robins perched in barren treetops. They're watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace signs that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter. It's winter in America. And all of the hillers have been killed or betrayed. Yeah, but the people know it's winter. Lord knows it's winter in America. And ain't nobody fighting, 'cause nobody knows what to say. Save your soul from winter in America.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we are now joined by former CIA presidential briefer and analyst Ray McGovern. And Ray, things are moving fast and furious in regard to Syria. There has just been a Senate committee vote in regard to the so-called authorization of force, and they're speaking of such a thing as a limited action of missiles and or bombs or other combinations, rather than an unleashed action. Can you speak to the latest developments in that regard?
Well, yes. The administration, of course, decided that it had to go to Congress because of the lack of support, even among our closest allies like Britain, and even among about 80% of our people. The way it wanted to sell this authorization for the use of military force to the Congress was to make it ostensibly limited. Okay, now when I say ostensibly, that's a well-chosen adjective there. Okay, what they're trying to do is to limit the ostensible scope, duration, intensity of this strike on Syria to quite openly retaliate, to punish is the word often used, to punish the Syrians for using chemical weapons against their own people. Now, if that strikes a familiar chord, we had a brutal dictator who used chemical weapons against his own people. His name was Saddam Hussein, okay? Now we have exactly the same wording being used just 12 years later. A brutal dictator using chemical weapons against its own people. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is that the evidence this time is far less convincing than the evidence that was adduced earlier on against Saddam Hussein. As a matter of fact, the evidence is contrived, it's unsupported, and it's glaringly unspecific. Now, those of us who have some experience in this, and I'm referring to intelligence officers, we wrote a memorandum just last Friday to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. There were 16 of us signing on to that memorandum with literally hundreds of years of experience in intelligence analysis and operations and military analysis. And we told the chairman of the Joint Chiefs that this was a very dubious collection of evidence, that even when Kerry came out later that afternoon with the so-called government assessment that was full of holes, very unconvincing, and for them to ask us to trust them without any specifics, without lots of contradictory information available, which they do not cite, was a little bit too much. And so we told the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, kick those tires, and when you go to Congress, make sure that Congress realize what's really going on here. If it weren't for having been through this 12 years ago, I would say, well, maybe, we can forgive congressmen and senators for being so naive. But, at the end, Robert, it's not naivete. What it is two things, principally. There is a cui bono aspect of this, those being Latin words for who benefits, to whose good this is happening. Now, there's one country in that area that is profiting from this war, and that is the country of Israel, which loves to see the Sunni and the Shia at each other's throats, which knows that this internal struggle in Syria has now become a region-wide struggle involving Turkey, Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, and Lebanon. And as long as the Sunni and Shia are fighting one another, they can't fight Israel, and they just destroy each other. So the only country that profits from a prolongation of this civil strife in which 100,000, count them, 100,000 Syrians have already died, with millions upended out of their homes, the only profit comes to the state of Israel. Now, what does that have to do with the United States? Well, it has everything to do with the United States, because the strength of the Israel lobby in our country, witness today the reports that AIPAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, Action, or whatever they call themselves, the ones that are the strongest lobby in our Congress, with the power to remove or keep Congress people in office, they issued a statement in full support of a retaliatory strike on Syria. Now, going back one step, and this is all important, Robert, I cast aspersions on the, quote, evidence, end quote, served up to prove, again in quotes, that the Assad government perpetrated these chemical attacks. There does seem to have been chemical exposures there, where hundreds of people have been exposed, and there do seem to be chemical damage. And sarin seems to be one of the chemicals used. But as eloquent as our Secretary of State, John Kerry, tries to be, he cannot persuade those experienced intelligence analysts like us that that information is conclusive. Witness the way it happened. The UN inspectors arrived in Syria 2 days later. With the UN inspectors in Syria, all of a sudden, there are chemical attacks. Now, why would, logically, would the Syrian government want to launch a major chemical attack while the UN inspectors are already there? Okay? Well, what happened was there was a cry to have the UN inspectors go into those areas. And the U.S. government said, well, no, we don't think, no, we have enough information. We don't need them to go into the area. And to his credit, the head of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, said, no, sorry, we have the inspectors there. They're going to go in, and they're going to find out what happened, what kind of chemicals they were, and who might have done it. And the U.S. was against that. Now, why was the U.S. against that? Why did the U.S. say that they could prove that it was the government? It made no sense for the government to do it. Now, John Kerry also said just 2 days ago that, the government is losing. The insurgents or the rebel forces are gaining ground, and that's why the government may have done this. Well, that's false on its face. There isn't any correspondence, analyst, even today at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, all those senators had been briefed and had said, well, we have to change the momentum. This is the way Senator McCain describes it. The need, and he claims to have been promised by the president, that they were going to change the momentum away from the winning momentum now by the regime, the Bashar al-Assad regime, into one that will favor the rebels. Now, either Kerry's right, well, McCain's right, okay? Kerry claimed that the momentum is in favor of the rebels. McCain says, no, the momentum is in favor of the government. That's why part of our operation here has to be not only to punish these people, not only to hopefully destroy the delivery systems they might use for chemical warfare, but number three, all important, and it was actually included in the final resolution, voted out 10 to 7 today, well, just a half hour ago. All important to McCain and to Lindsey Graham was this, quote, promised by the president, end quote, when he talked to them on Monday, saying, look, we're also going to supply enough arms aid to the rebels to change the momentum. Now, it's so frustrating for us who have been to Iraq to see how easily and how ready our legislators are to believe information that is much less specific than was used, for example, by Colin Powell at the UN, much less specific than the information used in previous incidents of this kind. All the government says is, we assess that. Okay, on the basis of X, Y, and Z, we assess that. They never give us X, they never give us Y, they never give us Z. Now, let me point to a person who has his head screwed on right normally, and his name is Walter Pincus. He writes to the Washington Post. He's been around a while. He's even older than I am. Okay, now what did he say? He said 2 days ago, look, Mr. President, you need to give us some concrete details here. We can't abide this notion of accepting your assessment. Indeed, your assessment was not an intelligence assessment. It was a, quote, government assessment, end quote. What does that mean? That means that the policymakers had their hand in this. That means that the people who wanted to retaliate shaped that statement. Usually, the Director of National Intelligence is the office that puts out some such statements as that. This time, no, it was a government assessment. Now, why do we feel so strongly about that? Well, we feel really strongly about that because no one really gave adequate attention to assessing the assessment. Now, we people in the trenches, Gareth Porter, for example, and I have written pieces that are up on the web, which explain why we are so distrustful of Kerry and what he is saying. But it's not got out to the media, and it's not gotten out to our legislators. Why is that important? Because the all-important premise upon which that whole session was just based this afternoon that I just finished watching was, the premise was, the government of Syria, the ruthless dictator Bashar al-Assad, has used chemical weapons on his own people, and parenthetically, just like that hated dictator Saddam Hussein used them on his own people in Halajba way back a couple decades ago. Well, ain't so. It's not proven. And so if you go with that premise and accept it blindly, as these senators today were so eager to do, you come up with a 10-7 vote so that America can be, as Senator Menendez, the chair, said at the very end, we are the sole indispensable nation of the world, and therefore we have to act on such things. Well, before we act, we should get our act together, and we should ask the experts whether the intelligence is reliable. It is not. The only problem now is that they've moved on and said the evidence is reliable. Everybody said that, even Senator Udall, even Senator Paul accepted the evidence. So if you accept the evidence and your major premise is false, well, then you're likely to do terrible, terribly foolish things. And that's what I'm deathly afraid will happen unless they start listening to people who know what the score is, or unless some relatively senior official or just some official within the intelligence and policy apparatus of our government shows the kind of conscience, shows the kind of devotion to his or her solemn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies. Unless some person like that comes out and says, I have documents in my hand here which proves that this is a crock, that this is a charade, this is exactly what happened before Iraq. And in with all due respect, some of these senators don't know about that. Some of them don't care to know, but there are five or six who do know. Nancy Pelosi does know, and she is so compromised by having approved A, torture, B, illegal eavesdropping on all of us, that she is going to go along with whatever powers be in Washington. And she's going to whip all her representatives into supporting this. The people need to know that. So I'm calling openly for an intelligence or policy official to come out with the appropriate documents to prove that this is, as I said, well, we say in the Bronx, it's a crock. I would say it's a charade. It's a scandal. And particularly scandalous is the behavior of the senators who can know better, should know better, and even worse, some of them do know better.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, this is a very odd circumstance in that we have a war that is not necessarily being conducted for oil, but funded by oil-producing nations, in particular nations like Qatar, nations like Saudi Arabia. And there is a report, I'm wondering if you are aware of it, from some of the Contras or the anti-government fighters in Syria who were not in great favor with al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda-linked leadership of much of the invaders of Syria at this point in time, in which they said that they were mystified by the shipment of equipment from Saudi Arabia, including tubes and canisters that looked like some kind of gas they were unfamiliar with. Are you aware of any reports that might indicate sources of the gas attacks from quarters other than the Syrian government?
Yes, there are at least a handful of such reports, some of them rather well sourced. A couple of them sourced to people on the spot. One report has it that the sarin gas, or whatever it was given to the rebels, and that they didn't know how to use it. And the I don't know if it's exactly this way, but the idea was they opened the can without realizing what it was, and all of a sudden it infected the whole neighborhood of people. Now, that's fully as credible as the notion, as Senator Kerry would have us believe, that we knew. We knew ahead of time. We knew that the government forces were getting their chemical weapons, rocket forces ready, that they were donning their or getting their gas masks ready, and we knew that days ahead. Well, you know, that strains credulity beyond the breaking point. And as a matter of fact, the rebels are saying, well, if you knew that, did you not think to tell us? did you not think to warn us? Like, we have some gas masks too, okay? So that's just one of the, I mean, Kerry claimed that it doesn't stand up to close scrutiny. He also claimed, as I said before, that the government was losing when everybody today at the Senate committee, having just been briefed by General Dempsey and everybody else, was saying the government is losing. Therefore, we have to reverse the momentum, as McCain said about five or six times. So, yes, again, one has to ask, who has an interest in having chemical weapons used in Syria? Now, does the government have that interest days after the UN inspectors arrived? I would suggest that's not likely. Okay. Now, who might have an interest? Well, who might have access to this kind of thing? Well, the Saudis have it. The Israelis have it. A fellow that I admire more than most other people, Larry Wilkerson, Colonel U.S. Army retired, who worked for Colin Powell for many years, even as Powell was Secretary of State. Larry Wilkerson suggested a month ago that it could well be an Israeli false flag operation. Well, why would he say that? Well, he says that, number one, because nobody else would dare say it, and because he has credibility. But number two, it fits the cui bono. It fits who profits from this. You know, if the Israelis get the United States involved in the war in Syria, that's the best thing that can happen to Israel. Look, what the Afghanistan thing was very much wished for and promoted by the Israelis. The same with Iraq. Now, those things didn't turn out real well for U.S. interests, but for Israelis' interests, quite well. Israel likes to have a partner. And one of the sort of less significant but very telling moments happened yesterday. There were weapons, there were missiles shot from the Mediterranean Sea toward the eastern shore, which, of course, is Lebanon, Syria. Now, who shot them? Well, the Israelis first say, well, not us. But then they say, well, yeah, actually, it was we. But we were doing it as a joint exercise with the United States. Well, you know, if there were further proof needed for all the Arabs who hate us already that the U.S. and Israel are involved in this thing together, and as our president said just a year and a half ago, that we, the United States, will, quote, march in lockstep with Israel, end quote. Well, that's the hang of it, because as long as the Israelis can get us identified with their interests, and as long, frankly, as they can get us to do their dirty work for them, namely, keep the pot boiling in Syria and become engaged, well, the only country that profits from that are the Israelis, and the only non-country insurgent group that profits from that is al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, which are the ones that stand to profit from what happens if Assad is surgically removed or if Assad and his government fall. Another thing that was brought up today, a legitimate thing, is what happens to those chemical weapons? If we knock out Assad and we decimate his army, who's gonna go into those storerooms and, you know, witness the fact that Syria does have an immense stock of chemical weapons? Into whose hands are those weapons going to fall?
Ray, there's one other angle here, and it was partly re-revealed this week when President Barack Obama dissembled to senators saying that American-backed Contras had been recently going into Syria through Turkey and other points in training centers with the CIA in Jordan. Now, NATO and Turkey have had a very large role in infiltrating Syria with U.S.-backed, armed, and trained invaders. Can you speak to that and of the possible countermeasures that might be brought forward to this invasion or attack by the actions of the Russian President Vladimir Putin?
Well, that's a very good question, Robert, and it rises in bas-relief now that our president is headed to Petersburg, where he'll meet with the G20, with the host being Vladimir Putin, okay? Now, this is what the president had hoped to avoid. Why did he want to strike Syria 8 or 9 days ago? Because he wanted to have it over and done with by the time he met with 19 other world leaders. Now, that's not the case. It's going to be very interesting to see what Putin says. I can hazard a guess, because I have a graduate degree in Russian studies. I studied the Soviet Union before it fell for 30 years. And this is my guess. Putin's going to say, Mr. President, we didn't do much when you invaded Iraq. We were in very good shape then. And besides, you know, it wasn't real clear what was going on there. But we know what's going on in Syria. We've been in Syria for decades, actually centuries. Catherine the Great. You probably don't know Catherine the Great there, Mr. Obama, but we do. And she had a big thing about Russia's soft underbelly, okay? That underbelly is even softer now that we've lost some of those Central Asian republics, but it's equally sensitive right now. We have a naval base or naval facilities we use in Latakia, Syria, and we have specialists that man some of their anti-aircraft weapons. Now, we will not stand by idly, Mr. President, if you obliterate those anti-aircraft weapons, which you'll have to do if you want to do an air cover sort of thing like you did in Libya. And we will not stand idly by if you decimate our capabilities in Latakia port. So be advised, this ain't Iraq, okay? We're much stronger now. We have a strong leader now. You're looking at them. There are limits to what we will tolerate. Now, that's a biggie. The other thing is Iran. Now, in many respects, the turmoil in Syria works to Israel's advantage in and of itself. But by relation to Iran, which has a military defense alliance with Syria, it also serves to bring up this bugaboo about Iran and how much a danger Iran is to Israel. Now, as most of your listeners, I hope, know, Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon 10 years ago. I'll say that again. 16 intelligence agencies say unanimously in the U.S. intelligence community, and they say it with high confidence, that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon 10 years ago in the fall of 2003. So why is Israel claiming otherwise? Why are the neocons who write for our newspapers claiming otherwise? Because they would very much like the United States to give Iran a real bloody nose, because Iran is the only rival of any significance in that part of the Middle East. So we have Iran and Syria. Iran is a Shia kind of arrangement. So, thanks to us, are most of the leaders of Iraq. And the Alawites that Bashar al-Assad heads, that's sort of like an offshoot of the Shia Muslim sect. On the other side, you've got the Saudis, and you've got al-Qaeda. Strange bedfellows, huh? And you've got the majority of the population in Syria, okay? Not to mention Egypt. And so those are the Sunnis. Now, these people, for reasons that I admit I don't quite understand, they hate each other. They hate each other from the last installment, you know, from the last movie picture, okay? And they're at it. And this is sort of, in Iraq, the violence has grown to what it was 3 years before we left. So, well, this is all going on. You have a situation where Israel dearly hopes that the thing will escalate far beyond a surgical strike on Syria and get us embroiled in a war with Iran if Iran does something really stupid. Now, I don't think the Iranians are this dumb, but if, to save face, if people start saying, well, don't you have a defense alliance with Syria? Aren't you going to fight the U.S.? If they are sensible and say, well, you know, let's see how things pan out here over the longer term. If they don't do that, but rather cause an incident that gives the U.S. and or Israel the pretext to give them a really bloody nose by attacking some of their nuclear electricity, their nuclear power facilities, then that would be, you know, icing on the cake for Israel. So what we have here is who benefits? Israel, and of course the people who make the arms, the merchants, the arms control industry, the people, the same people who control our media. And that's, of course, a huge part of the explanation as to why our media is still cheerleading for feckless wars. Look at who owns our six main media channels or outlets. It's GE, it's Motorola, it's all these folks that are profiteering on these wars. I don't say profiting, I say profiteering.
Ray, I want to thank you for such a deep analysis today on Earthwatch. And as the events continue to break and the rhetoric of American legislators and executives continues to go beyond absurdity and surrealness in terms of a limited strike, in terms of no boots on the ground, and the dubious constitutional issues, not to mention the international treaty proscriptions against even using the threat of force against a nation with which one is not at war. I really appreciate the thoroughness of your report and analysis today. How can people otherwise follow your good work?
Well, I have a website. It's Ray McGovern, just one word, raymcgovern.com. And I also publish first on the website called consortiumnews.com. That's consortium.com. And of course, if you tune into Consortium, you get an array of incredibly good writers and issues, more than I could possibly handle myself. So either one of those things, if you're interested in what I think, raymcgovern.com. Otherwise, consortiumnews.com. And let me just say one final word, and that is we have an opportunity now. I mean, this is probably our golden opportunity to influence our legislators, and I'm thinking mostly of the House. This is not a done deal yet. This president has not got complete control of the situation. If we show up and if we make sure that our legislators know how we feel about sending more U.S. troops, because that's what it eventually will be, more U.S. troops on the ground to fight for a war that benefits only Israel. They ought to know that, and they ought to make sure that the legislators know that and we won't stand for it this time.
Ray McGovern, thank you so much. This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And up next, presidential spokesmodel Barack Obama, the enabler of al-Qaeda in Syria and throughout the region, speaks more about the march towards war.
I put a spell on you. Because you're mine. Stop the things you do. What's up?
Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. These are the resources that we need to seize the initiative while building the Afghan capacity that can allow for a responsible transition of our forces out of Afghanistan. I make this decision because I am convinced that our security is at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is the epicenter of violent extremism practiced by al-Qaeda. It is from here that we were attacked on 9/11, and it is from here that new attacks are being plotted as I speak. This is no idle danger, no hypothetical threat, and this danger will only grow if the region slides backwards and al-Qaeda can operate with impunity. The people and governments of both Afghanistan and Pakistan are in danger. And the stakes are even higher within a nuclear-armed Pakistan because we know that al-Qaeda and other extremists seek nuclear weapons, and we have every reason to believe that they would use them. These facts compel us to act along with our friends and allies. Our overarching goal remains the same: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and to prevent its capacity to threaten America and our allies in the future. To meet that goal, we must deny al-Qaeda a safe haven. We must reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny it the ability to overthrow the government. And we must strengthen the capacity of Afghanistan's security forces and government so that they can take lead responsibility for Afghanistan's future. We will pursue a military strategy that will break the Taliban's momentum and increase Afghanistan's capacity over the next 18 months. The 30,000 additional troops that I'm announcing tonight will deploy in the first part of 2010, the fastest possible pace, so that they can target the insurgency and secure key population centers. They'll increase our ability to train competent Afghan security forces and to partner with them so that more Afghans can get into the fight.
One of the most worrisome things that emerges from the thick intelligence file we have on Iraq's biological weapons is the existence of mobile production facilities used to make biological agents. Let me take you inside that intelligence file and share with you what we know from eyewitness accounts. We have first-hand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails. The trucks and train cars are easily moved and are designed to evade detection by inspectors. In a matter of months, they can produce a quantity of biological poison equal to the entire amount that Iraq claimed to have produced in the years prior to the Gulf War. Although Iraq's mobile production program began in the mid-1990s, UN inspectors at the time only had vague hints of such programs. Confirmation came later, in the year 2000. The source was an eyewitness, an Iraqi chemical engineer who supervised one of these facilities. He actually was present during biological agent production runs. He was also at the site when an accident occurred in 1998. 12 technicians died from exposure to biological agents.
We have an obligation to be of help where we can to freedom fighters, lovers of freedom and democracy, from Afghanistan to Nicaragua.
Aren't you advocating the overthrow of the present government?
Not if the present government would turn around and say, all right. If they'd say, Uncle, all right.
In the 80s, there was Cold War drama. We fought the commies inside Nicaragua. Our friends were the Contras. Freedom was their mantra, so we sent them lots of money for guns and landmines. But Congress stopped the Contra money flow just 'cause they moved a teeny bit of blow. But then a hero came forth. His name was Oliver North. He and Reagan went around the sissy Congress. Ollie North, Ollie North. You see, North secretly sold missiles to a harmless country called Iran and would always be a grateful ally. Then he gave the profits to the Contras. Genius! But the sales were uncovered by the press. Reagan and North began to stress. 'Cause what they did was technically high treason. But it was totally justified. North volunteered to take the blame, to save Reagan from prison rape's shame. The truth he did bury with his hot secretary, thanks to her shredder. He got off totally scot-free. Ollie North, Ollie North, he's a soldier and a hero and a novelist. And now he's on Fox News.
My fellow Americans, as President and Commander-in-Chief, it is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply. The initial attack on the destroyer Maddox on August 2nd was repeated today by a number of hostile vessels attacking two U.S. destroyers with torpedoes. The destroyers and supporting aircraft acted at once on the orders I gave after the initial act of aggression. We believe at least two of the attacking boats were sunk. There were no U.S. losses. The performance of commanders and crews in this engagement is in the highest tradition of the United States Navy. But repeated acts of violence against the armed forces of the United States must be met not only with alert defense, but with positive reply. That reply is being given as I speak to you tonight. Air action is now in execution against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam which have been used in these hostile operations. In the larger sense, this new act of aggression, aimed directly at our own forces, again brings home to all of us in the United States the importance of the struggle for peace and security in Southeast Asia. Aggression by terror against the peaceful villagers of South Vietnam has now been joined by open aggression on the high seas against the United States of America. I have today met with the leaders of both parties in the Congress of the United States, and I have informed them that I shall immediately request the Congress to pass a resolution making it clear that our government is united in its determination to take all necessary measures in support of freedom and in defense of peace in Southeast Asia.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin a limited military action in Libya in support of an international effort to protect Libyan civilians. That action has now begun. In this effort, the United States is acting with a broad coalition that is committed to enforcing United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973, which calls for the protection of the Libyan people. That coalition met in Paris today to send a unified message, and it brings together many of our European and Arab partners. This is not an outcome that the United States or any of our partners sought. Even yesterday, the international community offered Muammar Gaddafi the opportunity to pursue an immediate ceasefire, one that stopped the violence against civilians and the advances of Gaddafi's forces. But despite the hollow words of his government, he has ignored that opportunity. His attacks on his own people have continued. His forces have been on the move, and the danger faced by the people of Libya has grown. I am deeply aware of the risks of any military action, no matter what limits we place on it. I want the American people to know that the use of force is not our first choice, and it's not a choice that I make lightly. But we cannot stand idly by when a tyrant tells his people that there will be no mercy, and his forces step up their assaults on cities like Benghazi and Misrata, where innocent men and women face brutality and death at the hands of their own government. So we must be clear. Actions have consequences, and the writ of the international community must be enforced. That is the cause of this coalition. As a part of this effort, the United States will contribute our unique capabilities at the front end of the mission to protect Libyan civilians and enable the enforcement of a no-fly zone that will be led by our international partners. And as I said yesterday, we will not, I repeat, we will not deploy any U.S. troops on the ground. As Commander-in-Chief, I have great confidence in the men and women of our military who will carry out this mission. They carry with them the respect of a grateful nation. I'm also proud that we are acting as part of a coalition that includes close allies and partners who are prepared to meet their responsibility to protect the people of Libya and uphold the mandate of the international community. I've acted after consulting with my national security team and Republican and Democratic leaders of Congress. And in the coming hours and days, my administration will keep the American people fully informed. But make no mistake, today we are part of a broad coalition. We are answering the calls of a threatened people, and we are acting in the interests of the United States and the world. Thank you very much.
I have also invited brother leader Gaddafi to this country. And I do that because our moral authority dictates that we should not abandon those who help us in the darkest hour in the history of this country. Not only if they support us in return, they gave us the resources for us to conduct the struggle and to win. And those South Africans who have berated me for being loyal to our friends, literally they can go and throw themselves into a pool.
Long live Mandela! Long live Mandela!
And those who have berated me for being loyal to our friends, literally they can go and throw themselves into a pool.
Wow. Unconfirmed reports about Gaddafi being captured. Unconfirmed. Yeah, we've had too many. We've had a bunch of those before. We've had, you know, have him captured a couple of times.
So, I mean, that is the land of unconfirmed reports.
Yes, we came, we saw, he died.
Did it have anything to do with your visit?
No, I'm sure it did.
What we've seen indicates that this is clearly a big event of grave concern. And you know, we are already in communications with the entire international community. We're moving through the UN to try to prompt better action from them. And we've called on the Syrian government to allow an investigation of the site because UN inspectors are on the ground right now. We don't expect cooperation given their past history. And you know what I do believe is that although the situation in Syria is very difficult and the notion that the U.S. can somehow solve what is a sectarian, complex problem inside of Syria sometimes is overstated, there is no doubt that when you start seeing chemical weapons used on a large scale, and again, we're still gathering information about this particular event, but it is very troublesome to some core national interests that the United States has, both in terms of us making sure that weapons of mass destruction are not proliferating, as well as needing to protect our allies, our bases in the region. So, you know, I think it is fair to say that as difficult as the problem is, this is something that is going to require America's attention and hopefully the entire international community's attention. America's attention and hopefully the entire international community's attention. America's attention and hopefully the entire international community's attention.
This is Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI in New York and streaming live at stream.wbai.org. I'm Robert Knight. And we now return to presidential spokesmodel and al-Qaeda collaborator Barack Obama with more on his unconstitutional Contra war on Syria, already in progress.
We are already in communications with the entire international community.
Hi there, nice to be with you. Happy you could stick around. Like to introduce Legs Larry Smith, drums, and Sam Spoon's rhythm pole. And Vern Dudley Bohay Noel, bass guitar. And Neil Innes, piano. To come in, Rodney Slater, alto saxophone. With Roger Ruskin Spear on tenor sax. Hi, Vivian Stanchel, trumpet. Big hello to Big John Wayne, xylophone. And Robert Morley, guitar. Billy Butlin, spoons. And looking very relaxed, Adolf Hitler on vibes. Nice. Princess Anne on sousaphone. Introducing Liberace, clarinet. With Donna Ted Armstrong on vocals. Lord Snooty and his pals tap dancing. In the groove with Harold Wilson, violin. Franklin McCormack on harmonica. Over there, Eric Clapton, ukulele. Hi, Eric. On my left, Sir Kenneth Clark, bass sax. Great honor, sir. Especially flown in for us, a Sessions Gorilla on Vox Humana. Nice to see incredible shrinking man on euphonium. Drop out with Peter Scott on duck call. Hearing from you later, Casanova, on horn. Yeah, digging General DeCall on accordion. Really wild, General. Thank you, sir. Roy Rogers on trigger. Tune in Wild Man of Borneo on bongos. Count Basie Orchestra on triangle. Thank you. Great to hear the Rawlinsons on trombone. Back from his recent operation, Dan Drop, hot. And representing the flower people, Quasimodo on bells. Wonderful to hear Brainiac on banjo. We welcome Baldunican as himself. Very appealing, Max Jaffa. Mmm, that's nice, Max. What a team, Zebra Kit and Horace Batchelor on percussion. And a great favorite and a wonderful performer, all of us here, J. Arthur Rank on gong.
This is something that is going to require America's attention and hopefully the entire international community's attention.
Breakdown.
Today we heard from President Obama that the war in Syria will be escalated. He now has agreed to send weaponry in to assist the rebels. It's escalation, that's the proper word, because we've already been involved for quite a few months. We've been supporting the rebels for probably the past 2 years, supposedly for humanitarian reasons. But now there's going to be a much more aggressive approach, and we're going to send weapons. There's a few problems with this. First off, it's war. Second thing is, presidents aren't supposed to start war without permission from the people through a congressional declaration of war. And besides, it's not going to do us any good to expand in another war. And now we hear that amongst the rebels are the Al-Qaeda. The Al-Qaeda's in there as well. So this foreign policy we've been following now for so many years is backfiring on us. It's backfiring on us because guess who's helping the rebels besides the United States? The Al-Qaeda from Iraq. Before the Iraq war, there were no Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now there is, and now they're over there helping, and we think we're going to sort this out after 2 years. The reason this is coming about is the rebels are losing this war, and we've been supporting the rebels, and I don't think it's possible to pick out the good guys here. I mean, there's no way. I think we should pick out the good guys over here, the American people and American taxpayer, and what's the best for America. And what we're doing here is not best in any way. The one thing that I find rather ironic, because I was very much involved in the lead up of the Iraq war, is the language is the same. They're using the same arguments. Weapons of mass destruction, poison gases, 100 people died. The government has done this. But you know what? They haven't used absolute facts. They haven't even used absolute language. They hedged their terms, and they said, yeah, possibly. A couple of weeks ago, our administration was admitting that some of this poison gas may have come from the rebels themselves. But 100,000 people have died over there, it's estimated. And they're saying maybe 100 or so have died from gas. Possibly. But who did it and when and why? And this is the red line. To me, it's all an excuse. This is, I think, sort of like what Clinton did in 1998 to get people to look at something other than the Lewinsky affair. There's a lot of scandal going on in this country, and it benefits the president to get the people's mind off. Nothing like a scare tactic on foreign policy to get away from the scandals. So this is, I think, really a lot what's happening. Besides, this whole idea, if you think about it, why would President Assad, who's winning the war, use poison gas to kill 100 people, knowing full well what would happen if people thought he was using poison gas? There's no way. The man is not an idiot. And now the assumption is, yes, this is the case. But here, over 100,000 have been killed, but the only thing that counts are these 100. You know, it's sort of like wondering why people aren't concerned about 100 or 200 or 300 killed on a regular basis from a drone missile. Why isn't that the red line? Matter of fact, I think the Al-Qaeda has red lines too. And when they hear that the U.S. drone missiles are killing civilians, they can get pretty annoyed. But we're falling down the path of what Bush did leading up into Iraq and what Clinton did, back in 1998 by bombing with his problems. He went and bombed Kandahar in Afghanistan. And they know about this, that this is a diversion tactics. So my concern is what has been my concern for so long. What are we doing there? Why are we there? What will it come of? How will we get out of it? I argued that same case about Iraq, and we're still messing that place up. We've actually had that backfire on us. Iraq now is an ally of the Iranians and actually still our enemies. A lot of people say, oh, we have to do it because this is what Israel wants. It may be. Israel may want this. I suspect that's their position. But I think that's a mistake. Not a mistake to be friends with Israel, but a mistake to do it this way. I think Israel's getting themselves into real trouble by supporting all this rebellion going on, whether it's Libya or Egypt or now in Syria and the mess we have in Turkey. This is instability. It cannot help Israel. So good intention, humanitarian instincts, but really what we're doing in the real tragedy is that the neocons are winning this battle here at home and they're controlling our foreign policy. And it's tragic that they are, because polls right now show that 68% of the American people say, don't go in there. We don't need another war. And you know, you think about the money. You know, we went through this sequester, and they'd nickel and dime and cut a few things and cut a couple TSA agents for a couple hours and tried to make a big deal of slashing. But never once has the president ever hesitated to promise more foreign aid and more military aid. So that has been all a charade about cutting, because there's no cutting here. This is expansion. And this, I think, is a lot more dangerous than Libya, a lot more dangerous than Egypt. Russia is involved with this, and Iran is involved. China probably is keeping their eyes on it, and it's not serving our interests at all. This is why I think it's so necessary for us as a people to once again think about the advice the founders gave us, about talking about a non-interventionist foreign policy, mind our own business. This compulsion and obsession to be involved when it doesn't even bother us. I mean, there's some in the Senate right now, there's the neocons in the Senate who are just shouting about why we should do a lot more and don't have incrementalism, go in there with full force. Well, I'll tell you what, the American people don't want it, we can't afford it, it's bad policy, It's not going to help Israel, and it's not going to help the rebels, because the rebels, we don't even know who they are, and if they truly are helped, it's probably going to help the Al-Qaeda. The weapons we send over there will probably end up in the hands of the Al-Qaeda and will be used against the American people. So it's time for the American people to wake up and let their members of Congress and their senators know, stop it. Why should you just sit back, let the president do these things and declare? They used to pretend, well, we don't need the congressional approval. We'll get it from the UN and get it from NATO. Well, in this case, he just does it. And nobody says anything, and the money will be there. But I tell you what, having been in Washington a long time, and the people that are there, except for a few, they're not going to say much. They're just going to go along with it. So it's going to take the American people to wake up and say, enough is enough. We're broke. We don't want this. No wonder we're in a constant recession. And no wonder that we are under constant threat by Americans being killed by the Al-Qaeda. And that is going to continue until we understand exactly the motives of those individuals who would like to kill Americans. And believe me, it's not because we're free and prosperous. It has a lot to do with drone warfare, occupation, and putting troops in other lands, putting on no-fly zones, and putting on boycotts and prohibiting these countries from minding their own business. So it's time for us to wake up, because this one could get out of hand, and that's what I fear, because eventually we're going to have a financial crisis which will be related to this endless spending.
There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty. Against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom, there has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Now, of course, one of the difficulties in speaking out today grows out of the fact there are those who are seeking to equate dissent with disloyalty. It's a dark day in our nation when high-level authorities will seek to use every method to silence dissent. Something is happening and people are not going to be silent. The truth must be told, and I say that those who are seeking to make it appear that anyone who opposes the war in Vietnam is a fool or a traitor or an enemy of our soldiers is a person who has taken a stand against the best in our tradition. Many persons have questioned me about the wisdom of my path. Why are you speaking about the war, Dr. King? Why are you joining the voices of dissent? Peace and civil rights don't mix, they say. And so this morning I speak to you on this issue because I am determined to take the gospel seriously. I speak out against this war because I'm disappointed with America. And there can be no great disappointment where there is no great love. I'm disappointed with our failure to deal positively and forthrightly with the triple evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism. We are presently moving down a dead-end road that can lead to national disaster. America has strayed to the far country of racism and militarism. All men are made in the image of God. All men are brothers. All men are created equal. Every man is an heir to a legacy of dignity and worth. Every man has rights that are neither conferred by nor derived from the state. They are God-given. Out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. What a marvelous foundation for any home. What a glorious and healthy place to inhabit. But America strayed away. And this unnatural excursion has brought only confusion and bewilderment. It has left hearts aching with guilt and minds distorted with irrationality. It is time for all people of conscience to call upon America to come back home. Come home, America. I call on Washington today. I call on every man and woman of goodwill all over America today. I call on the young men of America who must make a choice today to take a stand on this issue. Tomorrow may be too late. And don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you are too arrogant. Now, it isn't easy to stand up for truth and for justice. Sometimes it means being frustrated. When you tell the truth and take a stand, sometimes it means losing a job. It means being abused and scorned. It may mean having a 7 or 8 year old child asking your daddy, why do you have to go to jail so much? I've long since learned that to be a follower of Jesus Christ means taking up the cross. And my Bible tells me that Good Friday comes before Easter. Before the crown we wear, there is the cross that we must bear. Let us bear it. Bear it for truth. Bear it for justice. And bear it for peace. Let us go out this morning with that determination. And I have not lost faith. I'm not in despair. I haven't lost faith because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when the lion and the lamb will lie down together and every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree and none shall be afraid because the words of the Lord have spoken it. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all over the world we will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. With this faith, we'll sing it as we are getting ready to sing it now. Men will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nations will not rise up against nations. Neither shall they study war anymore. And I don't know about you. I ain't gonna study war no more.
You are listening to Earthwatch on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. We welcome your comments, leaks, and suggestions with an email to your host, rknight@wbai.org. That's rknight@wbai.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
I don't want no.
A racist, Glenn Beck is a racist. Gaza Strip was getting bombed, Obama didn't say
shit. After you divorce yourself from the right wing propaganda campaign, it's all simple and plain. America could stand the game. Your president got an African name. Now who you gonna blame when they drop them bombs out of them planes using depleted uranium? Babies looking like two-headed aliens. Follow the money trail that leads to the criminal, and nothing subliminal to it. That's how they do it. See the game they run. Give a fuck who's cunning, articulate, and handsome. Afghanistan held for ransom by the hand of this black man. Neo-colonial puppet, white power with a black face. He said, puppet, I'll do it. A master of disguise, expert at telling lies. Then they gave him a Nobel Peace Prize. Should have known he was trained in Chicago. Word to Chairman Fred and Mark Clark. What they do in the dark will come out in the light, like a WikiLeaks site. So I guess Nkrumah was right. Who's ready to fight? Last stage of imperialism. I ain't kidding. In the immortal words of Marvin Gaye, this ain't living.
Spanish. O-B-A-M-A. You ain't fooling everyone, I see the games you play. You was VIP at the BIC, and we know that's a code name for CIA. A-A-A. The same way your cameras are watching us, we're watching you. Think we're easy to control, you ain't got a clue. Revolution's on the way, let's see what you're gonna do. You're gonna send the troops, you're gonna drop the nukes. See, it's not where you're from, it's where you're at. He's sitting in the White House, so who cares if he's black? And why is there soldiers still out there in the rack? Natural resources ain't yours, it's theirs, give it back. You're just another puppet, but I'm not surprised. Look at Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice. They didn't change, ish, house niggas fresh off the slave ship. You all burn in hell, even Michelle Obama nation.
Strip was getting bomb, Obama didn't say
shit. Who's the bigger threat, from Osama or from Obama? Military bases from Chagos to Okinawa. I say things that other rappers won't say, cause my mind never closed like Guantanamo Bay. Hope you didn't build a statue or tattoo your arm, cause the drones are still flying over Pashtunistan. Did he defend the war? He extended more, even had the time to attempt a coup in Ecuador. Morales and Chavez, the states are on the hunt for ya. Military now stationed on bases in Colombia. Take a trip to the past and tell him I was right. Ask Ali Abu Nima and Jeremiah Wright. Drones over Pakistan, Yemen and Libya. Is Obama the bomber getting ready for Syria? First black president, the masses were hungry, but the same president just bombed an African country like...
Strip was getting bomb, Obama didn't say
shit. The Jonas Brothers are here. They're out there somewhere. Sasha and Malia are huge fans. But boys don't get any ideas. I have two words for you. Predator drones. You will never see it coming. You think I'm joking?
Do you think this war will ever end?
I don't know. They'll just have another one.
I want to get out of here. Don't you?
Not that much.
So you like it here?
It's not that bad.
You're in a foxhole with a war raging outside.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org. Now, do it now.
This Thursday morning from 6 to 8, WBAI presents A Delicate Balance, remembering Marion McPartland. Marion, who passed away last week, began her radio career right here on WBAI in 1964 and brought her classic taste in jazz to our air for the next 14 years. We'll talk with those who knew her, and we'll let Marion select our morning's music. This Thursday, September 5th, from 6 to 8 a.m. on 99.5 WBAI and WBAI.org.
Hi, this is Marion McPartland, and that's The Intimacy of the Blues. Duke Ellington at the piano. And that's one of my all-time favorite records. We're going to call this show A Delicate Balance.
Thursday morning at 6 on WBAI.
Music will be delicate, and we hope it will all
Hi,
be.
Hi, I'm Rosie Perez, and this is WBAI.
And it is WBAI, and this is Jim Freund. I am live. I am so, so sorry. I'm having a really fascinating, fun discussion over the history of BAI. and stuff like that right outside our studio here with Ahmad Ali, who comes on the air very shortly. And I'm taking a look occasionally at my tablet and stuff like that. And all of a sudden I go, holy fud, my show's already begun. And so now I've come in here and now I'm telling you this, and now I'm discovering that the my little folder of themes isn't on this computer. Well, haha. That's why we have USB thingies. And actually, here in these studios, I'm sorry, I'm just looking at a memo. Don't let the door lock as it hits you in the ass. Don't forget background briefing at 5 a.m. As ever, I can't read this. Oh, it's loaded in the top of card player and sign on, take readings. Well, I don't know who it is who's supposed to sign on now, but hey, I know I'm supposed to begin. And oh, yes, look at that. Here is my opening theme music. It will be a fun and yet somber show. Because, sadly, we are going to be dealing with, has it stopped playing? Where are the headphones? Do we have headphones in this room? Jeez. Yeah, it stopped playing. Okay, I'm safe as far as it goes to start my theme music. So let's do that, and then you'll find out what it's all about. Shall we try that again? See if the player will play? Oh, for God's sake. Somebody screwed up this computer. Which always happens. Stand by while we tell it that WAV files are to be played with something different. Okay, here we are. I think. Yeah. There's my wolf. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly science fiction program, or something like that. I usually say weekly radio program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. But, oh, I began so screwy this morning and all that, to the point where I'm just going to begin the show now. Let the theme run under me instead of letting it swell up and talk over me and playing music. Because we have an agenda this morning. And to do that agenda, I'm going to have to do what I always do is wax poetically, hopefully, and so perhaps somewhat accurately, about my own life and WBAI. I began volunteering here in 1967, and I was working for Baird Searles, who was our drama and literature director, and a major maven within the world of science fiction. I was sort of an acolyte, as it were, and through him I was meeting some of the great people in science fiction. And I was also getting involved in science fiction by attending parties held by the Science Fiction Writers of America and the Nebula Awards. By the way, the Hugo Awards were this past weekend. And I was very pleased by some of them and very shrugged by others. And if we have time, I may discuss it. But I was attached to the music department in the Free Music Store, and I was working with Margot Adler, who was just stepping down as news director to start a radio show in January 1972 called Hour of the Wolf, Mondays through Fridays, 5 to 7 a.m. It was actually a deal that Adler made, that if she would step down as news director and accept unemployment, she could get this show. And BAI wasn't on the air 24 hours a day. We'd sign off somewhere between like 3 and 5 a.m. or whenever FAS or Post, whoever was on the night before, felt bored. So they rarely got off by 3, and in the case of Bob, sometimes not by 5, but that was okay. It's free-form radio, as was Hour of the Wolf. But I got to do a couple of fill-ins for people as the science fiction maven. And I got to do my very first live radio show with as sole host on my own somewhere in 1971. I have the tape at home, but it's on a 10-inch reel-to-reel tape, too, because each 10-inch tape at 7.5 inches per second is 1 hour. And I do have these, but, you know, they have to be transferred into something digital. And WBAI doesn't have the resources to do them. And if you want to see what it takes and how many tapes, I have literally over 1,000 hours of tape that need to be turned into digital stuff. There's a very good little documentary about my tape collection on a site called narrative.ly. But if you go to my Facebook page, you'll see I've got it pinned, also in the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. So anyway, so I don't have that tape. Why is that relevant? Because my first guests were three of the top names in science fiction. Isaac Asimov. Okay. I had met Isaac at some Nebula Awards function. And he said, yeah, sure, I'll do your show. So it's like, okay, how do I get in touch with you? Do you have a card? He said, no, you just look me up. I go to the phone book. And I look up, and there's, you know, Asimov, comma, Isaac. West 81st Street. I thought, well, you know, it's a celebrity. Can't be. I call up. He goes, hello. I said, Isaac, it is you. I didn't think I'd actually, you know, that this was you listed in the phone book. He said, I know. I've been trying to get them to list me as the Dr. Isaac Asimov, but they won't do it. Typical Ike. Typical Isaac. You know, that ego. So, and by the way, yes, that's a fair approximation of his voice. Anyway, Isaac, I was scared stiff. Isaac was quite a handful. He was a very effusive personality, and he had friends, and I had friends that were pros, all-time pros on radio, because they were regulars on Long John Nibble's show on WOR. And they were Lester Del Rey and Frederick Pohl. Fred died yesterday. 93 years young. If I had been hosting the show truly on my own, it would have been a disaster. But Fred Pohl was a pro. He made me look good. He kept Isaac in line, which is not, let me tell you, an easy thing to do. And by the way, Happy New Year, everybody, for those who observe New Year at this time of year. And I became pretty good friends with Fred Pohl. Not close or anything. We didn't socialize. But he was at Bantam Books. He was an editor there. And I could earn a little money doing proofreading, a little first reading, analysis of unsolicited manuscripts, and stuff like that. And as the editor at Bantam,